This is Dr. Marvin Dunn, and this is The Storyteller with my brother, Dr. Raymond Dunn, and technical assistance from my nephew, Raymond Dunn Jr. The topic today, Miami's first black millionaire, D.A. Dorsey.
Bruh, thank you for that introduction. I really do appreciate it. And bruh, I am so anxious to hear about D.A. Dorsey. Now, when was D.A. Dorsey's time, bro? What do you mean by early Miami?
Well, Dana Dorsey was a black man who was born in Georgia, Quitman, Georgia. I'm not sure he was born there, but he came here, came to Florida from Quitman, Georgia.
Okay.
Arriving in Kissimmee at about the time the Flagler Railroad was being built up in that part of the state. So Dorsey, who had been trained as a carpenter, as a young man, young boy, signed on with the Flagler organization before the railroad even reached Miami in 1896. Mm-hmm. He knew where the railroad was headed and got to Miami, got to what became Miami before the railroad got here in 1896. So he arrives with skills of a carpenter in a town that was being founded that needed a lot of houses for black people. But that was his entree into what would become Miami.
But why would Miami need a lot of black labor at that time?
Good question. It was black people who built Miami. It was black labor that put the railroad in. Never mind but the money. The money came from Flagler.
Right.
The muscle came from black men.
And the idea came from Julia Tuttle.
Well, kind of, yeah, but that's another story.
Okay, trying to put it all together.
Part of it came from her, but Mary Brickell, you got to consider what she had to do. She was one of the early matrons in early Miami, the Brickles. So she also had something to do with the railroad coming to Miami.
Okay, but the importance of the black people, you said that was a large black working population here. Okay, so what were they doing?
Let's back. You're going too fast.
Okay.
Before Dorsey got here, there were just a few scatterings of black people here.
You have black people
living in Coconut Grove.
Okay.
You have some black folks living up in Lemon City, which is now a little Haiti. But around the Miami River, which is now downtown Miami, where the river runs into.
Right.
Very few people lived there at the time. The Tuttles were there. Julia Tuttle, her family was from Ohio. Mm-hmm. The Brickles were on the other side of the river, the south side of the river. Even before the Tuttles, the Brickles were here. Mm-hmm. And you had other, like the Wagners were the first white family that had a home in what became Miami. These white folks were here, but they lived in places around the mouth of the river. So the story goes that Julia Tuttle was able to convince Flagler to bring the railroad all the way to Miami after the Great Freeze of 1894-1895.
But just for context, see, you got to understand, people are hearing
they don't know what the Great Freeze
sometimes
is.
For all the right. first time. Tell us, what idea did Julia have that convinced Flagler to come? She mailed him something.
Well, Tuttle always wanted, once she settled herself here at the mouth of the Miami River, she thought that a city would bloom if the railroad was extended from, at that time, Palm Beach, a little above it at that time, really.
Makes sense.
All the way down to the Miami River. But Flagler was not all that interested in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
His plan was to have the railroad stop at Palm Beach, where he built a beautiful home, a mansion for himself and his second wife. Tuttle wanted him to bring the railroad all the way to Miami. He really didn't. And then this event happened. This freeze happened. It was incredible. People had never seen anything like it. Fish froze in the Florida Bay. It was so cold. The temperature in Jacksonville was 14 degrees for 4 days. Everything stopped. The freeze just brought Florida to a screeching halt, and the state was just now beginning to bloom. The citrus industry was just getting started in Florida when this thing happened in 1890, the first freeze. It was two freezes.
Mm-hmm.
So this freeze happens, knocks out cattle, vegetables, the new budding orange trees killed. But things sort of warmed up, and folks thought, well, you know, we may be okay. The trees started to come back out, and the second freeze hit and killed everything to the ground. So the Great Freeze was actually two freezes in a row that really just destroyed North Florida.
Right.
It was so cold that
North and Central, right?
Central Florida, yeah, exactly. All the way down past Lake Okeechobee.
Mm-hmm.
So the story goes that when this happened, Julia Tuttle, who now was living at the Miami River, on property that's basically where the James O. Knight Center is now. That was her property back in the day. Right. And she owned the land all the way up to what's now 20th Street. That was all Tuttle property. Never mind how she got it. That's another story. So the story goes that Mrs. Tuttle went into her backyard, and there was an orange tree that was blooming. And this woman took an orange blossom and sent it to Flagler at Whitehall, his mansion in Palm Beach. And Flagler saw that even though the freeze had hit Florida pretty badly, orange trees were blooming at the Miami River. Therefore, if I take my railroad there, mm-hmm. People can grow crops and get them out of Florida to the markets in the north, and I can bring tourists. Mm-hmm. So that was really the impetus for him making that decision.
What a smart idea.
Well, but hold on. See, the ladies like to tell that story.
Okay.
Female historians love to tell the Julia Tuttle orange blossom story, which is romantic and all of that. But that didn't really happen.
You're kidding.
Well, orange trees don't bloom in December. There were no orange blossoms to send the flag.
Wait a minute. Do you know I never thought about that?
No trees.
I've heard of that story for years.
No trees were blooming. What she did, she did promise to give him half of her land and all of that.
But she did.
But the story is that one of Flagler's foremen on the railroad was at the Miami River when this happened, and he took some plants, some bushes and things up to Flagler, and Flagler saw that these things were not frozen. So whether Tuttle, the farmer who sent bushes up to Flagler, or Mary Brickell, because she too was in contact with the Flagler folks that were bringing the railroad all the way down. So Flagler decides to bring the railroad to the Miami River. Miami gets established in 1896, a new town, and it is heavily, heavily black because blacks were needed to build the railroad.
Wait, back up. You said Miami was established.
Yes.
That meant that it became officially incorporated as a city.
1896, correct.
How many people did they need to incorporate the city?
And well, they didn't have enough. They didn't have enough.
Well, that's my question. Where did they come from?
Well, the state required a certain number of registered voters for an area to become a city. Mm-hmm. Miami didn't have that many white men. Women didn't have the vote at that time, so only men voted. So there were not enough white male voters at the Miami River to qualify to become a town. So the Flagler organization ordered its black men who were registered to vote. They didn't vote often, but they were registered to vote to come to this meeting to incorporate the city, and they showed up. The jobs depended upon it. So you had 368 or 367 men at that meeting to incorporate the city, and 162 of them were black.
But the black vote only counted as a half of a vote. Is that
true? No, they had the full vote.
Where in my study of Miami history did I get that blacks who helped to incorporate Miami, their votes were only counted as a half of a vote?
And I never heard that.
Oh, okay, all right, move on.
So anyway, the city is established. We have a lot of black people here because you got to build streets, mm-hmm. you got to put in streets, you got to put up buildings, you got hotels now being built. The magnificent Royal Palm Hotel mm-hmm. that he built at the Miami River, mm-hmm. gorgeous building. All the Flagler's hotels were painted yellow with white trim.
Oh, as a Florida historian, you and I have been wrong a number of times. Is it true that in almost every city that he stopped in as he came down Florida building his railroad, he put up a hotel like that?
That's correct.
He put up the first big hotel in all of these cities.
That's okay. Jacksonville, St. Augustine.
All the way down.
Palm Beach. All the way down to Miami, where he built the Royal Palm, okay. which was, I think, I don't want to be wrong about this, but I think it was the first hotel that had a swimming pool. Mm. There are photographs of it. I saw one recently of these white folks lounging around this beautiful pool at the Royal Palm.
Wait a minute. No blacks?
Well,
in the pool?
No.
Okay, go ahead, bro. Go ahead.
This is 1901.
Okay, tell the story.
Well, that's not what hit me about looking at that picture. What hit me about looking at that beautiful picture of the pool at the Royal Palm was... Mm. Black people built that pool.
Yeah.
They built everything. The hotel itself, black labor put that up. So anyway, my point is you had now a lot of black people here because of the nature of the work that was needed to put the city up and to lay it out and all of that. And the Flagler organization designated the northwest quadrant of the new town to be colored town. And that's where the black folks were expected to stay, were required mm-hmm. to stay. So if you didn't live in Coconut Grove or Lemon City or some white person's property here or there, as you came in with the railroad and wanted some place to live, you lived in Color Town. Mm-hmm. That was very typical of the railroad. I want to make this point, Ray, because I think it's important. Mm-hmm. The railroad, the Flagler Railroad, put black folks in the northwest quadrants of all these towns. Mm-hmm. If you go to West Palm Beach, where are black folks?
Every place is in the northwest.
Right. Where are black folks in Fort Lauderdale?
The northwest.
Come
because,
on down.
Because that was over there.
It was over. Right? Well, the idea was to have black people, black workers, close enough to be able to walk downtown or walk to their work, their jobs, but to be out of sight.
That makes sense. I've never heard of that.
Right. And then it's easy to control them. If you have them living in one section. So people had, black folks had to be in Colored Town, and you really could not operate businesses downtown. You couldn't be outside of Colored Town after a certain hour at night unless you had some reason to be out of Colored Town.
Question. Now you got all these black workers. They got to live someplace in the northwest section of the town. Did any blacks take advantage of trying to help out with the housing?
Oh, that brings us back to D.A. Dorsey, the carpenter, who was here before the railroad came. Well, the first photograph that I saw of early Colored Town was a wooded area with tents that the railroad distributed to folks to have a place to sleep when they were arriving here to work. But Dorsey starts out as a common, he did common labor. He didn't come in rich. He did common labor, saved his money, and started buying lots, pieces of land. Sometimes he was paid with land instead of money. And after a while, he acquired enough land to stop putting up little shotgun houses that were needed for these folks arriving in Colored Town. Now, shotgun houses, you've seen them.
Of course.
They're pretty simple, easy to make. I talked to somebody, incidentally, when I was doing a story on Coconut Grove, those Bahamian houses, shotgun houses in Coconut Grove. And this lady told me, she was in her 90s when I interviewed her 30 years ago. She said, Dr. Dunn, those shotgun houses were all the same, all the same. She said, we would start to go to school one morning, and they'd start putting in 10 of them all right together. Mm-hmm. And by the time we came home from school, they'd all be
finished.
It was not a complicated thing. Mm-hmm. So Dorsey took advantage of this simple architecture and basic need for housing and built some of the first housing for the black residents of Colored Town, which later became known as Overtown. And he became wealthy.
How wealthy?
We'll never know how wealthy, but I tell you this. He did business with Flagler. He did business with Tuttle. He did business with the Brickles. I have the records. His daughter gave me his papers. I have them in my collection at FIU.
What was he ever confirmed as a millionaire?
Yes. He was a very rich man.
Question. How did he help blacks, other blacks, with his fortune through all these buildings?
Well, he gave away a lot of land. For example, the Dorsey High School, which I attended when our family moved.
We both attended.
Dorsey High School, that on land donated by D.A. Dorsey. The Dorsey Library in Overtown. Dorsey Park. Well, I don't think he donated the land. I think that park was named after him. But the point is, he gave away a lot of land. He also served as superintendent of colored schools. So even though he himself, I think, had about an eighth grade education, if that, was in charge of deciding who could teach in the black schools in Miami at the time. So if you wanted to be a teacher, you were black, came to Miami, all you needed, exactly, you went to his house, you sat down at his table, he would interview you, and he would decide whether or not the school board should hire you. At that time, to be a black teacher, you just needed to have gone to the eighth grade. To work in a white school, you needed to have gone to the 12th grade. So there was a differential in what was expected of black teachers. Disparity again.
You named a number of properties, but one that you didn't name was Fisher Island.
Yeah, maybe we ought to talk about that.
Yeah, I think so.
Before the railroad came in, black people could get into the ocean and swim. The railroad comes in and they stop that. Blacks no longer have access to the ocean. So Dorsey had the idea of building a resort for black tourists to come to Miami and for local blacks to be able to get out to the ocean. And at that time, what we now know as Fisher Island was not an island. It was a peninsula. It was just an extension of what's now Miami. They put in government cut, and that's what made it an island.
Right.
Before that, it was land out there. Mm-hmm. So Dorsey comes up with the idea of buying about 21 acres of land on what became Fisher Island to build this resort for black tourists and for local blacks to have access to the ocean. Now, this was 1918 when he made this purchase. Mm-hmm. Ray, he didn't own that land more than a year when Carl Fisher, the man who developed Miami Beach, purchased it from him. Now, the story sort of goes dead from there, but here's what I think happened. when white people found out that Dorsey had bought that land east of the railroad now, mm-hmm. it outraged the white people. It outraged them. Now you had black people coming down to the mouth of the Miami River mm-hmm. to get boats to go out to the Black Beach, mm-hmm. right at the backyard of the Royal Palm Hotel.
Exactly.
You're coming down for your vacation to go to Miami, and now you're
black
watching
people over there swimming.
Exactly. Look out across the peninsula, and there are black folks out there. So we don't have the full story, but pressures were brought on Dorsey to sell that land, and he did. Carl Fisher bought it and became Fisher Island, one of the wealthiest pieces of land in the country, mm-hmm. where you have multi-million-dollar estates out there now.
Exactly.
But Dorsey's daughter, Dana Dorsey, told me that her father bought that land and had to sell it because of the Depression. But that wasn't correct. The Depression happened in the 1930s. Dorsey sold that land in 1919.
Yeah. Okay. So the first story seems more likely to be the truth. Yeah.
But you're asking about things that he did to help blacks. D.A. Dorsey was the first black person who was allowed, I use that word intentionally, allowed mm-hmm. to buy a car when cars came out. But black folks weren't allowed to buy cars. Dorsey did. If you got into trouble, young black man, Dorsey would put you in his Cadillac, drive you to 20th Street, which was the city limits, give you a couple of dollars and set you on your way. A lot of black men who were being chased by the police or the Klan or somebody else, the boss man or somebody, got help from Dorsey. Mr. Dorsey took them and gave them some money and got them out of town. He was also, I think...
May I interrupt?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Dorsey gave some white people some money too, didn't he?
Well, not gave.
Well,
he loaned old man Burdine.
Okay.
The Burdine store was the most successful store in downtown Miami.
Exactly.
Mind you, black people could not operate stores in Miami. And old man Burdine was a captain in the Confederate Army. So it gives you an idea about the background of the But I think his son had taken over the store by the time Dorsey got involved with the Burdines. But whether to old man Burdine or whether to Roddy Burdine, who took over the store from his dad, the Burdine store was in trouble in the Depression. D.A. Dorsey loaned the store $30,000, documented, not rumored.
Mm-hmm.
Depression wanes. Burdine sends a check to Dorsey for the amount of money that he loaned plus interest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, at the time that this deal was signed, Dorsey became part owner of the Burdine store.
Mm-hmm.
Depression is over. Burdine sends a letter telling Dorsey, here's your money, thank you very much, and you're no longer part owner of the store. According to Dana Dorsey, his daughter, when Burdine was dying, he sent for her father to come to his bedside. She said her father went. Mr. Burdine begged him to forgive him for what had happened between them. She said, Dr. Dunn, he didn't forgive him for that. He let him take that right to his grave. But I tell you, the Dorsey family was the only black folks who could use the elevator at the Burdine store.
The rest of us?
Had to use the stairs. Mm-hmm. Actually, you didn't have any business in there.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, the Burdine store, not just Burdine, Sears, all of them downtown. Black people couldn't try on, well, let me back up. Black men could try on clothes in Burdine's. Black women couldn't. Black women couldn't try on clothes anywhere. White women couldn't try on clothes for a long time. So shopping at these stores for a black person was undignified. You had to wait till white folks got waited on before you got waited on. You got offered substandard clothing or whatever you're trying to buy. So black folks spent that money in Colortown. And for that reason, you had a lot of very successful black businesses in Colortown because that's where black folks spent their money.
Exactly. And then we had a lot of different businesses, as you just said, to be successful in Colortown. So let's fast forward now. We know about the nightclubs. We know about the hotels. Mm-hmm. Here comes Interstate 95. What happened to our businesses?
Well, the interstate comes through, and it really cut Overtown in half. Now, mind you, D.A. Dorsey was dead. I don't remember the year he died. Yeah. But by the time the interstate came in the early 1950s.
Late 50s, early 60s.
He had passed on. But that interstate ripped out the business center of Colortown, now being called Overtown. And the folks' housing for thousands of people was wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, the folks who got damaged by the incoming interstate, who had to move out of their houses, were black folks who were renters. Mm-hmm. So the folks who really got the money when the interstate came through were the white folks who owned the land.
Property. Right.
Now, D.A. Dorsey was a successful black businessman, and he did put in a lot of housing in Overtown, but he didn't own most of it.
Mm-hmm.
He owned a relatively small amount of housing in Colortown. Most of the housing in Colortown then and now was owned by folks who were not black. White folks who invested, who lived in New York or Miami Beach. So the coming of the interstate economically didn't benefit blacks who had to move. A lot of them moved to Liberty City. Then you couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
That was my next question. Where is the black community now?
The black business community in Overtown is struggling mightily. But keep in mind, it was not the interstate alone that destroyed black businesses in Colortown.
What else did it?
Integration.
Well, true.
Integration. If you could go and stay at the Fountain Blow, why would you stay at the Mary Elizabeth?
Right.
In Overtown. If you could spend your money at a white nightclub or a white, integration had as much of a deleterious effect on Overtown as did the interstate. Unintentional damage by integration, we know. We can cite it throughout all kinds of spheres of influence, education and what have you. So one of the detriments to Overtown was the fact that this interstate came through and made it possible for people to spend their money elsewhere and to live outside of Colortown. So integration, the coming of the interstate, were the two factors that led to the decline of Overtown.
Now, I know you've done numerous tours through Overtown over the years. So what is it like now?
What is it like now?
Yeah.
That's a good... If you go to Overtown today, let's say 3rd Avenue at 8th Street, between 8th and, say, 14th Street,
mm-hmm.
and look east towards downtown, what you will see is a canyon, a wall of buildings moving towards you across that railroad track.
Coming to the west.
So what was desired in the first place by that interstate coming down the way that it did, and cutting Overtown in half like that, what was desired was for the downtown business community to be able to move to the west,
right,
to expand. And for that reason, they didn't need to have that interstate coming down that railroad track, which was an option at the time, come right down the old FEC railroad.
Yeah.
Right. If they put the interstate down the railroad track, it would not have displaced so many people from
exactly.
Overtown, because the railroad track was not operative that much and was open, wide open territory.
I definitely remember that argument.
Yeah. But remember, the white community did not want the interstate where the railroad was, because then they could not move west. And they knew they couldn't move east. That was the ocean. Could move north Miami. Could move south, Coconut Grove. The only way that the business community could expand was to the west. And that meant into Overtown. And that meant they didn't need that interstate coming down that railroad track.
Right.
They needed it coming down 7th Avenue, way, way farther west, so that they could do just what we see happening, the gentrification of Overtown, which may have been unavoidable, but it was certainly expedited by these factors that we're talking about. So I would think that probably in another 10 years, most of the folks who will be living in Overtown will not be black.
What do you see the future of Miami's racial mix being, now that you have a substantial Hispanic population from very Cuban to Puerto Rican, whatever, you have the Haitian population, you have the Jamaican population. What do you see Miami becoming now?
Well, to begin with, African Americans like you and me in Miami will become a minority within a minority, because most of the black folks in Miami, in Dade County eventually, will be from the islands. Foreign-born or foreign descendant. So African-Americans are in decline as the Caribbean population increases. I think you're going to see a tremendous amount of gentrification of Overtown. I think we may save a few buildings, like the Lyric Theater and a few other places will likely be preserved. There are a few places like the Lyric Theater that might survive. The Longshoremen's Hall is now probably going to survive, but not much. Anything that can be developed commercially in what's now threatened Overtown will be developed commercially, just a matter of time.
Let's wrap this up. So we go from early Miami, Julia told the railroad and all of that stuff, and then we talk about D.A. Dorsey and what he did and others did, and you mention to us what Miami is like now, okay, whether or not the businesses are surviving, the mixture of people. So as we close this story, what do you see as the future for this African-American generation of blacks in Miami?
For the African-American?
Yeah.
Segment of the black community? I think more and more of them will move away to other parts of the country. I think a lot of them will move to black communities in other areas or integrated communities in other areas, because even though you have a black population that has Caribbean blacks and blacks from South America and what have you, African-Americans are becoming, I think, so ethnically diluted that it's no longer an attractive environment for a lot of African-Americans. I think we'll lose more and more of them as the community becomes more and more consisted of foreign-born black people.
So, bro, thanks a lot for all of that information on D.A. Dorsey. We know that D.A. Dorsey died in 1941. Is that right, bro?
He passed in 1940.
In 1940. But my question to you is, what is his legacy now?
His legacy is having been the first really rich black person in what's now Miami.
Okay.
That's important. And then what he did with his wealth, even going so far as to try to buy a place where black people could get into the ocean. His legacy is his wealth. It is his venturing into areas that were unknown for blacks at the time. His legacy is his effort to buy that property, to have a beach for black people, to be able to get into the ocean. But basically, I think his legacy is that he was the first truly successful black businessman, first really successful black business person in Miami.
Well, bro, thank you very much for those stories, especially for this one on D.A. Dorsey, someone who is so important to Miami. Thank you, bro. For a full accounting of this and other stories, visit us at donehistory.com or Through Black Eyes Unfiltered Podcast. This was a production of MR2D Media. Thank you.